Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I understand after an eventful late afternoon on the Eisenhower, a suspect in the Jaslyn Adams murder is now in police custody. And I didn't get all the details. So a white cop, I presume?
That shot him? I don't think anyone cares on this one. Everybody wanted that monster behind bars.
No. A white cop is the suspect, I presume.
Oh,
I mean,
no.
Why else would we be covering it?
No.
Why else would the Chicago media be covering it?
Oh, no. We're covering it because it was a high-profile crime. People say, you know, they were shot at a drive-thru at McDonald's. No, they were ambushed, Dan. These two thugs got out of their car and fired 50 rounds into the car, plugged her with 6 bullets, and the dad got shot. And, oh, by the way, the dad spoke yesterday, the gangbanger.
That's my baby I just lost. I got shot once. My baby got shot 6 times. My baby got shot 6 times. They still ain't tell me what she got shot at.
Well, he shouldn't have been in a gang. That's why he was shot at, according to police yesterday. So, yeah, the suspect was in his home. What?
Pump the brakes. Details on dad's gang affiliation.
According to Superintendent Brown, who had a press conference yesterday, dad was involved in a gang, and this was a gang-related shooting.
Right.
That continued afterwards. There was another shooting at Popeyes in Humboldt Park.
So, you're at a drive-thru with your 7-year-old, and two people get out and open fire. And yesterday, or the day before, dad speaks out. That was the press coverage. Dad speaks out. They haven't told me what happened. Mr. Adams, do you know what happened? Mr. Adams, why would two people, do you have any idea why two people would open fire on you in your car while you're at a drive-thru at the McDonald's? Do you have any intuition on that?
Everyone walks around on eggshells. You know, don't ask the tough questions. Might be too personal.
Yeah.
Because he knows damn well why his daughter is dead.
So that's where the question should be lodged initially. All of this, you know, the Joe Friday stuff, that's all interesting. Fine. Do we want to have one of those real conversations I hear so much about police, about violence and policing and race? Okay. What's the race of the suspect? What's the race of the individual who's been charged in the shooting of that toddler on Lakeshore Drive?
Black.
So I know these stories will go away quickly as soon as somebody's charged. They'll throw a mugshot in the air and they'll say, you know, that's it. We've done it. Done. They won't ask the father why he thinks he got ambushed. They won't talk about this problem of violent crime being committed by a small percentage of people in a small percentage of neighborhoods that is having a huge negative impact on minority communities, the Black community in Chicago and elsewhere in particular. Are those unfair statements? Are those untrue statements? Are we adult enough? Are we strong enough? Are we brave enough to risk having that conversation? This who, what, where, and why. Yeah, right. Everybody's got that. I want to have the conversations that are always described but never had. So what about it, Mr. Adams? And if you have some idea why you may have been targeted, what do you want to say about your daughter's murder? What do you want to say about the life you may have been leading? I don't know. I mean, I'm going by what Superintendent Brown said, just like you were, Amy. But let's assume Superintendent Brown is right, if he's right. Any comment on the life you're leading? Do you have any comment for gangbangers in Chicago? Do you have any comment for young black men and how they should think about their lives, how they should value their lives, how they should do productive things, how maybe they shouldn't do the things that you did?
Yeah, that this might be a graphic example that you should not be in a gang.
Did Triple Threat weigh in on this?
Which
any
one?
Crocodile tears?
No, who took it for was Janice Jackson, who said, I remember being a kid and how special the time was when you got to go to McDonald's with your father and sit in the drive-thru to get your...
Such an important comment from the CPS superintendent.
So here we go again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tell us more about this. Tell us more about the number of CPS students that are murdered every year. Do you have any comment on that, Ms. Jackson? And I don't want to hear about your childhood. I'm not interested in your childhood. You're here. I'm interested in their childhoods that may or may not be here in the next 6 months, year, 2 years, 5 years. Oh, I remember this. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for sharing your truth. Who cares? Tell me about this. Tell me about what's going on here. No comments? Where's everybody rushing to the cameras?
Where's BLM?
Is Al Sharpton coming in on his jet?
I don't know. He spoke at Dante Wright's funeral yesterday.
Yeah, of course
he
did.
They're so close. What a political stage hack that was.
Is Reverend Flager out of timeout? Can we get a Reverend Flager comment? Supich, Cardinal Supich, where are you? Teletubby down in, I was going to say down in Springfield, but he's never there.
No, he's not there.
Where are the community leaders? How about the socialists on the city council? How about the aldermen for these South and West Side wards? Danny Davis, you have anything to say?
Danny Davis wants gun confiscation.
Oh, I know.
That'll make it all better.
But what about specifically in this instance? Is Mr. Adams familiar with firearms? What do you have to say to Mr. Adams, Representative Davis?
It's a career path he chose, to be in a gang.
Larry in Elmhurst.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Hey, you know, the reason he got shot up like that, well, the reason that there's nobody saying anything because there's no money to be made off of this, but he got shot up because, and his daughter got murdered because of him, because he was in the cemetery urinating on a gravestone of an opposition gang member, and it was videotaped.
Well, I didn't hear that.
I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, where'd you get that
information?
If you go on
the app World Star, and you can see it.
Video?
The app World Star.
Okay.
It shows a video of him and another gang member urinating on the grave, and then you could hear somebody in the background yelling at them, and they just walk away flashing gang signs at them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Real deep stuff. I mean, I remember a time.
Was he
when gangbangers, just let me say that, when gangbanger kids were off limits. When I lived in Detroit, when I first got here in Chicago, it was an underwritten rule. You never touch kids, and if the kid's in the car, you do not shoot at the car. You don't take the half-court shot.
What does Mr. Adams do for a living? He's got a daughter he has to support. Anybody know?
All I know is he's a gangbanger, well-known gang member.
No, I want to hear from Mr. Adams.
Well, I wish I was at that vigil. I would have asked him.
Yeah.
I would have asked the tough question.
Did you think
this career path you chose put your daughter's life in danger?
Let these individuals speak. You allow them to share their emotions on camera. No questions? Not interesting. Didn't strike you as unusual that a father and daughter would be ambushed at a McDonald's like that? doesn't prompt any questions in your mind, Chicago Press Corps. Oh, right. Not that interesting, right? We'll do this job. We'll wring our hands. 48 hours or maybe a little bit longer, depending on if they are able to find who is responsible. And we'll put that one away next to Hedia Pendleton, Darian Albert, on and on and on. And then we'll get back to what's going on in Columbus, Ohio. Because that's the story we want. You got there, you got a white cop, and you got a black teenager. That's juicy. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560 The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and take out your pen and paper. We have a ransom note from the No Justice, No Streets people up there in Minnesota. The George Floyd Autonomous Zone?
Yes.
That sacred place that, as Gail King termed it, where police have not dared to go since George Floyd's killing.
Really?
Murder, now.
It's called George Floyd Square, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where 19 people have been shot and 5 killed. Sacred. The list of demands here for, I guess, the community to reclaim public property from these goons is 24 items. Quite a long laundry list here. They want the Hennepin County attorney fired. They want certain police officers and other criminal justice personnel fired. Establish an Office of Independent Investigation and Prosecution for Minneapolis law enforcement. Really focused prosecution on law enforcement. Sure, you need an agency for that. Require law enforcement officers to maintain private professional liability insurance. Ban the indemnification of cops and qualified immunity. Invest $400,000 into the George Floyd Square Zone. Invest $300,000 into the George Floyd zone. You know, one for $400,000 for this, $300,000 for that. Really doesn't matter. Establish temporary suspension of property tax increases for residents of the George Floyd zone.
Why are you laughing? We demand fair taxes.
George Floyd zone is going to be the new Beverly Hills, huh? Ah, tax is going to be a Hong Kong. It's going to be tax free. Include a rent-to-own option in new housing construction for renters. Sure, I mean, you just work around these inconveniences like property rights, obviously. Allocate a facade grant to George Floyd Square to improve the aesthetics.
What?
Why would the aesthetics need to be improved?
It looks, I mean, there's only so many Mylar balloons you could fit in a square.
Well, yeah.
And the candles and the dead flowers, and it's just, it needs to be cleaned up.
I would think that these community organizers, these activists, these leaders, I would think that they would take it on their own initiative to beautify the area, to show just what great and benevolent overlords they are.
Well, in George Floyd's $27 million settlement that he got, $500,000 of that is going to be allocated to that district for, I don't know how they're going to use the funds, but that's $500,000.
Yeah, well, they got all kinds of ideas.
Okay, what else?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, you get a flavor of it.
Yeah. Well, that's a lot to ask for. I mean,
give me cash, eliminate the police, release my criminal buddies. I mean, that's sort of how it goes.
Put a moratorium cap on my taxes. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. Taxes for thee, but not for me, so on and so forth. Well, Brian Enten, who is a correspondent for an outfit called News Nation Now. He was at the site doing a little bit of look-see, since nobody in the political press corps seems to want to, because it's a sacred space. And that's certainly how they treat it. Brian Enten was cutting a piece outside of the sacred space, and that's how this is how that went.
This area behind me is the George Floyd Memorial. This is where George Floyd was killed back in May. Take a look. These barricades have been set up by protesters and supporters of the movement. They don't allow anyone in, not even the police. It's called an autonomous zone. And
You're going to be in a bad situation here in a second.
Oh, I thought if we were on this side of the barricade.
You're going to be in a bad situation in a second. You've been called out for what you are, and you need to get out of here.
Please go.
We know what you are. You need to get in your car and go.
We're just media.
I don't give a f*** who you are. You've been called out for who you are. You need to get your car and
It's very tense near the memorial, and a militant-style group has closed off several blocks with barricades.
What?
It's about to get bad for you here. Oh, is it?
Get in your car and get out. We know who you are. Get the blank out.
Well, that's one thing for these two soft, dopey white people dressed in black to chase the reporter off. I wish I was on site there.
Oh, that would be
me
fun.
And some of my criminal friends. Oh, I'm about to make a bad move, am I? Help me. Help me understand that bad move. What's the move that you're about to make? But I digress.
George Square looks disgusting. You need to gross.
Yeah, these autonomous zones are not the socialist utopias that they're advertised to be. I think we saw that in Seattle.
Right.
Now we're seeing it in Minneapolis. It's not really been reported much. I wonder why. Brian Enten then spoke to a woman, a black woman, whose nephew was one of those killed in that sacred space, the George Floyd Autonomous Zone.
The situation at the memorial is, from what I understand, is kind of volatile. People that want to go and support doesn't feel a sense of inclusion. There is more of a like militant type atmosphere over there and a sense of fear.
Kim Griffin supports police reform and was outside the courthouse protesting Floyd's death, but she does not agree with what's happening at the memorial. Her nephew, 28-year-old Amez Wright, was shot and killed there over the weekend.
Were police able to get in and help him? Or
police were not allowed to get into that area. He was carried outside the zone of George Floyd Square.
But not allowed by who? I mean, they're the police.
The law enforcement, it was made clear law enforcement was not welcome to penetrate that zone, which is an atrocity because his life was taken. And, I mean, who knows whether or not he would have survived had things been different.
Oh, Dan, that's awful. I didn't know this was going on. And you're looking at the pictures, it's just disgusting.
I'm sorry, officers. You're not welcome here. Everybody can create their own autonomous zone wherever they are. Perhaps in the commission of a crime. I know you see me holding up this liquor store, but my friend here that I'm pointing a gun at and myself have decided that, I'm sorry, officers, you're not welcome here.
Well, and the police officers, I mean, they've been so demoralized in Minneapolis, and half of them, a fourth quit, that they probably are like, yeah, okay, you don't want us to go in there? Fine, we won't go in. Just bring him out. Bring his body outside of the square so we could help try and save his life. I mean, it's so ridiculous.
Let's not defund police. Let's just make Chicago one big autonomous zone, sort of a sanctuary city for the Americans. Right? What do you think? No law enforcement. We don't do law enforcement with respect to people here illegally, except if they commit violent crimes. But how about we just wrap it all together? Chicago, one big tribute to George Floyd, one big autonomous zone. What do you think?
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. I feel like we have autonomous zones by the lakefront, though, Dan, with these homeless camps that are set up. And there's the city gave them their own porta potty because they were defecating on the street, which we got to witness one time. That was real fun. Good morning. And you can't walk down that side of the sidewalk.
Defecating on the street. What do they think they are? A school superintendent?
The pooper intended. No, I'm serious. You can't walk on that side of the sidewalk when you're trying to get to the lakefront on Wilson because that's their home. It's scary. They scare me. I'll admit it. I get scared.
You just put up a little placard that says Black Lives Matter or defund police or no justice, no streets, something pithy.
Okay.
Declare yourself off limits to the laws of this nation. Mm-hmm. And there you go.
I mean, I remember a time when Mayor Daley at night would have Engine 70 come out there and just spray. Oh, it's time to clean the streets and just get out the hoses and spray the homeless people away.
Well, I don't.
I mean, that would look. I know, but I'm just saying that that's. But now they set up camp. There's camp again. They've got their three little communities.
Well, as long as everybody's living their truth, that's what's important to me. Mm-hmm. Amish. I think Amish is thinking about a conversion because he's been calling in a lot, and that is going to get him shunned. Amish texter Huntley.
I'm more interested by transmission to across the cheddar curtain.
Transition, there. Yes.
Yeah. But anyhow, I'm going to seek out the Amish community up there. But I think that the George Floyd would be like the business community or the e-commerce committee there. Besides the flaming facade improvements, I think one of their demands is to change the name of the Twin Cities to Minneapolis St. Floyd.
Thanks, Amish. Minneapolis St. Floyd has a nice ring to it.
I'm telling you, there are going to be elementary schools named after him. There's going to be fields named after him.
Well, I know.
Remember, he was high, had fentanyl and meth.
I don't remember any of that. I remember his name is synonymous with justice. I remember that he sacrificed his life for our sins.
Oh, that's right.
I remember that he rose on the third day. Tony and Roselle.
You know, I was listening to the demands of the Autonomous Zone occupiers, and they're vaguely familiar to me, and I realized that when terrorists take hostages, they demand the release of compatriots, financial demands. This is very much like a terrorist organization.
Yeah, it very much is. Yes, it is. Thanks for the call, Tony.
I mean, if they're not letting police in when someone's shot to render aid, shame on them.
Shame on who? What do you mean they're not letting?
I know. What am I saying? What this happened? America. Oh, my God.
The difference is with terrorists normally, diehard, the police are going to come in. They're there to come in and apprehend the terrorists. Here, when you say, I'm sorry, officer, this is off limits to you, apparently they just turn around and say, well, actually, they probably never show up because they probably have a stand down order from the mayor to not show up. Oh. Just leave them alone. Oh, okay. And the woman you heard from, her 28-year-old nephew, mm-hmm. who was killed in the autonomous zone, that's a sacred space. Black Lives Matter, right? John in Bridgeport.
Hi, guys. Just real quick. Amy, you're familiar with the public school system. And for the last 30, 40 years, they've had a big rush to anti-bullying, anti-picking on people, blah, 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 blah. Well, next time you hear an educator talk like that, tell them to look in the mirror and to go pound it, because that's exactly what these people are from BLM and Antifa and educators who are protesting. They're trying to bully their way in to get what they want. Screw that.
Yeah. Thanks, John. Tom in Deer Park.
Dan, I think you're being a little harsh in the situation. I'm seeing this autonomous zone where these people they're doing a little urban camping.
Yes.
Urban camping.
Glamping.
And,
I love glamping.
Yeah, and they're having a Marxist rule. To me, this is just an urban version of the white supremacy camps that they always hear about out in Idaho, where they're pretty much doing the same thing. They're the right-wingers, and this is the urban Marxist left-wingers. So I suggest just, as a libertarian, I'd leave them alone.
All right. Thanks for the call, Tom. Mike in Union.
Hey, good morning. Hey, I was just curious, with all the financial numbers that you were listing, I was curious if Hunter Biden is back into making negotiations again. But then again, I doubted it. I didn't hear a Rolex watch in those numbers, unless I'm mistaken, Dan.
This is small potatoes for Hunter, Mike. Too small a deal.
Yeah.
He doesn't do deals this small. Oh. Carl in Frankfurt.
Yeah, what's up, guys?
Hello.
Hey.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, good.
First time caller.
All right, great. Welcome aboard.
Listen to you guys for a long time. Hey, I wanted to tell you the autonomous zone demands to me sound a lot like the Chicago Teachers Union.
Yeah, they behave similarly too. Thanks for the call, Carl. Good call. Call back.
Yeah, please.
That's a good comparison. Well, I mean, it's what's it's just it's just different extortion rackets, right?
They're extortionists. Yes.
Vince in St. Charles.
Good morning, guys. You know, this is insane having this. And, you know, I blame all my friends, so-called friends, that vote for a Democratic Party that aren't paying attention because the union vote back in the Hoffa days. They're not paying attention, and this is what you get. Biden, that doesn't pay attention to the Democratic Party. This is what you get.
Thanks for the call, Vince. Mike in Plano.
Hey, guys. All these cities are run by these liberal women and these beta males, and these people were basically raised to be free spirits, do what thou wilt, if it feels good, do it. And now they're put in these positions of authority where they have to say no, and they can't because they have no concept of order. So we can't expect these people to run institutions that require a certain level of order and structure.
It's a good point, Mike. You know, thanks for the call. Yeah, so in terms of the civilian political leadership in Minneapolis, St. Paul, like here, you know, how to describe them? Mike did a pretty good job. Let me see if I can provide a little bit more texture here. They're the kind of people like that eunuch Josh Fry.
Oh yeah,
Frey or Fay, whatever his name is in Minneapolis.
Little mini Trudeau.
Yeah, exactly.
They look alike.
Yeah. They would, so like Fay, and Trudeau, let's say, they would like to go to this event hosted by the League of Women Voters of Wilmette and the Wilmette Public Library Book Group. We'll be discussing Mediocre, the Dangerous Legacy of White Male America. What? From the New York Times bestseller, So You Want to Talk About Race, A Subversive History of White Male American Identity. Will Zinfandel be served? What happens to a country that tells generation after generation of white men that they deserve power? What happens when success is defined by status over women and people of color instead of actual accomplishments? That is on tap this coming Wednesday at
date night.
Exactly.
Let's go.
It's a date night. Well met. Which is about
my burlap sack. What do you want to wear?
Which is about the least racially diverse community in the state,
of course, by the way.
Yeah. I mean,
all their white guilt, and they have money, and they're like, what should we do? We feel so bad.
So these are the people in charge, and these are the people who think things like the George Floyd autonomous zone is a good idea. Right. The smart, successful, rich people. Yeah.
The woke, well-read liberal.
Yeah,
the bane of my existence.
Right. They define success by the amount of their trust fund. Clay and Wheeling, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Just one quick comment before my autonomous zone comment. Have you ever heard the conspiracy that Justin Trudeau is Fidel Castro's illegitimate child? That Fidel used to go up to but anyway.
With who,
yeah.
Oh, with Trudeau's parents.
Both of them?
If you look at, Fidel Castro allegedly slept with Trudeau's wife, mother, uh-huh. And that's how Justin Trudeau came to be. But if you look at the father comparisons, Justin Trudeau looks a lot more like Fidel Castro than his own father. But anyway,
fascinating.
I support the autonomous zone. I 100% agree. But I want a one-way door and a 20-foot wall around it. All these idiots want to go in and shoot each other and stab each other and not have the police there, then so be it. I'll let them be, but I want a 20-foot wall around it. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Let's just make them thunder domes, autonomous zones. Thunder zone.
Oh, can we take Chuck and Delavan?
Yeah, Chuck, hey.
Hi, Chuck.
Hey, Chuck, but from Delavan, first-time caller, long-time listener.
Yeah.
Thank you, Amy, for naming my high school band My Liar Balloon. I got a Teletubby sighting yesterday. I was out in the woods hunting turkeys, and I didn't go. But we had a Teletubby sighting from one of my informants, Mars for appetizers, and then Cafe Calamari for dinner. I won't be able to close your show today. I'm sorry. My crazy girlfriend's making me go in front of a dermatologist today because I'm always running around with my Daisy Dukes on when I'm farming. And she wants to make sure I don't have skin cancer. Well, sorry. But you guys have a nice day. I won't be able to talk to you today at 9. Love you.
All right.
All right. We love you too, Chuck.
Thanks for the call, Chuck. Thanks for
Tubby sighting.
Thanks for adjusting your schedule, too. I don't want to be in an autonomous zone where Chuck from Delavan is wearing Daisy Dukes, though. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. As some parents in some school districts still grapple with something approximating a pre-COVID-19 learning environment for their child, my question is, have you addressed your school board? I'd love to hear from people who've actually taken the time to go to a school board meeting and address the school board or meet with the superintendent, taken some material action to force a dialogue with your elected officials and other individuals in charge of your child's education. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. We've seen some instances. I mean, I know these are just representatives. There's many more people who've done it than this. But instances where people have gotten particularly exercised about the state of affairs in the school district, the father in Loudoun County, Virginia, young man in Naperville. I mean, he didn't really get emotional. He was very room temperature, and he just decimated the school board there in Naperville because apparently there's very few adults that want to do that. Georgia mom, Courtney Ann Taylor.
She's my new crush.
She addressed her school board recently about the mask mandate.
Every month I come here and I hear the same thing. Social, emotional health. If you truly mean that, you would end the mask requirement tonight. Tonight. This is not March 2020 anymore. We have three vaccines. Every adult in the state of Georgia that wants that vaccine is eligible to get it right now. And every one of us knows that young children are not affected by this virus. They're not. And that's a blessing. But as the adults, what have we done with that blessing? We've shoved it to the side and we've said, we don't care. You're still going to wear a mask on your face every day, 5 and 6 year olds. You still can't play together on the playground like normal children, 7 and 8 year olds. We don't care. We're still going to force you to carry a burden that was never yours to carry. Shame on us. My 6-year-old looks at me every month before I come here and she says, are you going to tell them tonight? Tell them I don't want to wear this anymore. And I say, baby, it's not time to fight that battle yet. I try to explain that there's so many things. But it's April 15th, 2021, and it's time. Take these masks off of my child. And I know what I'm going to be met with. But Ms. Taylor, the CDC, we did not vote for people at the CDC. We did elect leaders who do create policy. We elected the five of you. We chose you to make difficult decisions for our children. We chose you to make decisions that would be in our children's best interest, enforcing 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9-year-old little children to cover their noses and their mouths where they breathe for 7 hours a day, every day for the last 9 months for a virus that you know doesn't affect them. That is not in their best interest. And this has to stop. Defend our children. My 6-year-old can't come up here and say this. It has to stop. Take these off of our children.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. And, you know, as parents, you try to fight battles that you can maybe win. That's why a lot of parents, I think, at CPS just didn't even bother to fight Goliath because they knew there was no hope. But this woman, she's going to make a difference. I mean, she's already started a change.org petition to try to get them to wake up because she's right. We have given our children, they're carrying a burden that was never theirs. We're treating healthy people as if they are sick, and teachers are doing that. And that's why we're masking up, and it's ridiculous.
Our friend John Tierney, writing over at City Journal, the research on this we've talked about so many times, but just to refresh, masks may provide some protection for some high-risk adults in crowded indoor settings with all sorts of predicates like the mask, the quality of the mask plus the quality of the fitting. But the evidence is mixed. And Masks can be not just uncomfortable, but harmful. Some adults may judge the trade-offs worthwhile for themselves. But for children, there's really not much there, because what Ms. Taylor said is, you know, is largely correct. Obviously, it's nothing's 100%. Some children have been infected. Some children have died. But, you know, you're talking about the risk of being struck by lightning, and actually not even that risky. But Tierney writes, the mask mandates are especially cruel to young children. Adults are supposed to ease their fears, to reassure them that monsters aren't hiding under their bed. Instead, we're frightening them into believing they're being stalked by invisible menaces lurking in the air. And this is really interesting. I hadn't heard this before. A year of mask wearing will scar some of them psychologically, and maybe physically too, according to a team of Italian professors of plastic surgery who warned that prolonged pressure from the elastic straps could leave young children with permanently protruding ears. Then they'd be called Dumbo for the rest of their lives.
Well, Don Lemon had protruding ears, and he got them pinned back.
It's great.
I'm just letting you
I'm
know.
I'm very
that,
happy
yeah, for Don.
Don Lemon.
Changed his career.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to the story. Sorry.
By hiding teachers' lips and muffling their speech, mask wearing makes it harder for young children to develop linguistic skills, prevents children with hearing impairments from lip reading. Unable to rely on facial cues, teachers and students of all ages are more likely to misinterpret one another, a particularly acute problem for children on the autism spectrum. Mm-hmm. How are children supposed to develop social skills when they can't see one another's faces, sit together, or play together? There's actually site that's been set up to catalog some of the problems. Researchers at the University of Wittenherdecke in Germany established an online registry for parents to report on the side effects of mask wearing. Among the nearly 18,000 parents who chose to respond, not a random sample, obviously, more than half reported that the masks were giving their children headaches, making it difficult for them to concentrate. More than one-third cited other side effects, increased reluctance to go to school, unhappiness, malaise, impaired learning, drowsiness, fatigue.
And besides, if I may, this mask wearing, the CDC has got to change the guidelines now for quarantining people. Because they, you know, well, Dan, we have 700 kids quarantined in Naperville. District 203. We have 155 at Hersey. We have were in a class with someone, and you test negative.
There's the CDC guidelines, and as Ms. Taylor said, we didn't elect the CDC. We elected you. That's not on the CDC. That's on the Naperville School District.
All right. Then they need to wake up, because we're never going to go back to school. We're never going to go back to normal, because somebody's always going to have a cold, which they don't even know they have a cold.
So
these people are asymptomatic. Not one hospitalization at Hersey, Naperville, Oswego East, Amundsen.
So attention needs to be focused where accountability should reside. And you're not going to get a one-on-one with Dr. Rochelle Walensky or Dr. Fauci. So you might want to try your local school district where it's happening.
Right, or IDPH.
They're in charge of their school district.
Well, the IDPH put out guidelines for the school districts, which the school districts are following, which are stupid. You're supposed to, these are the rules because I read them. If you're in class with somebody less than 6 feet for more than 15 minutes, you have to quarantine. And so everyone's quarantining now, and there's no school. Everything's remote. Not everywhere, but most high schools.
Jay in New Lenox.
Hi, Dan. Thank you, and I appreciate you taking me here. I was a parent of New Lenox School District 122, and in August, the week before we were set to go back to school, the Illinois Department of Public Health came out with new guidelines that now force told our superintendent decided to go remote. We went to the August board meeting, talked, and then they said to basically contact our representatives and the IDPDH. So my wife went and got a group and did that. We came back again in September at the board meeting and again talked about what we did, and that it was time to, you know, to open up the schools. And I'm very proud of our school district and the superintendent, Dr. Lori Mach. She got the schools back, got the students back in school, and you know, they've been in school full time. I think they had to take 2 weeks off in January, and then they had to take some, I think after Thanksgiving, there was a little bit of time and they went remote.
But they went back in school, and if they didn't, I was going to be able to have to go find another place to live because we couldn't afford the Catholic schools, which had been back the whole time, which was brought up at the meeting. Yeah. And so, if you don't speak up, though, they're going to do whatever they want. And I'm also a public school teacher at another district. I just want to tell you that you've shared things like the Fryer model, I think it was Roland Fryer, and it was another, it was talking about the discrepancy because we're all this stuff about white supremacy, white fragility, and we're having these discussions in schools and at our school. And it's really, I think, doing a disservice to our students because they're going in and they're being told that they're a victim. And when you go and bring up the different things, like when you show the one chart, I forgot the name of it, but it was the chart that showed the amount of money that people made compared to the single mothers.
Yes, right.
And so I think that that's a message we sent the kids, if you want to have kids, get married first. If you want to go in and get a job, get your high school diploma, there's opportunity here. Don't go and allow yourself to have that victim mentality that somebody owes you something. So I appreciate those things you bring up because I use that stuff with discussions I have with other people. And you provided a lot of courage, I think, to go out there and you bring this stuff out, and it helps me to go and say, yes, there's another side to this issue. It's not just a one-sided issue that we have in these discussions. It's a controversial issue, and you should be bringing out both sides, just like I do as a teacher. When I say we have a controversial issue, we're going to look at both sides of the arguments, and I'm going to let you think critically for the student to decide. And I think that discussion has been removed and has been, we're going to tell you what to think. We're going to tell you what to do. And if you don't, we're going to shame you. And I think that you've been a force in bringing that out to say, don't be ashamed. Have courage. And once you have some courage, guess what? Other people are going to join in the fight as well with courage. So I thank you for that, too.
Thanks a lot, Jay. I appreciate the call. Only minor critique. I mean, you are a teacher, but minor critique. Don't call your kid's school superintendent doctor. She's not a doctor.
All right.
That's it.
Right.
But otherwise, I appreciate the call, and I'm glad you're utilizing some of the material and hopefully opening some minds, young and old alike, in your circles. That's great. Dan in Downers Grove.
Hey, Dan.
Good morning. About 3 weeks ago, I gave up wearing a mask. I refuse to wear it anymore. There's only been two times where somebody told me to put on a mask. I drop my goods and I leave the store.
Yeah.
I'm tired of it. I'm not doing it any longer. And if more people would stand up and do it, it would work. I've been to Home Depot. I've been to a major restaurant downtown known for crab last night. Nobody said a word to me.
Mm-hmm.
So people just got to stand up and say enough is enough.
Thanks, Dan.
Try that at Whole Foods at Belmont and Nashland and then call me.
Well, they won't.
Oh, my God, they'll their hair will be on fire.
No, they'll descend into a puddles of tears about
you
how you're
care
you're,
about you're, people.
You're killing grandma and grandpa and the kids that we otherwise are fine
well,
with.
Grandma and grandpa have been vaccinated by now. If they haven't, shame on them.
Boy.
Well, I'm sick
taking
of that. We're,
a hard
we're
line
changing
on
our
grandma and grandpa.
I am, because I keep hearing about, oh, but what about grandma and with the kids that live with their grandparents? Then they need to get vaccinated or separate themselves and live in separate rooms, something.
Yeah.
Sacrifice something for the kids now, because we've given up a year of our lives for you, Grandma.
All right. Amy Jacobson calls for internment camps for Grandma and Grandpa. All right.
Come on. It's enough already.
Well, it was always silliness, and it just continues to be silliness. But this is an example. Once we have come up with something that works and shaming people, where people are like, well, I don't know, it puts people back on their heels, then we're just going to repeat it. It doesn't matter if the facts on the ground change. It doesn't matter if every person over the age of 65 been vaccinated. We're still going to say it because it works.
God, I had a humongous woman yesterday say to me,
how
pull up
big
your...
was she?
She was so big that she made J.B. Pritzker look like a size 8. No, she said, pull up your mask over your nose. I'm like, oh, don't even start with me, honey. Don't start with me. And I just walked away.
And then you got hair pulling?
No.
Was there hair pulling?
She couldn't reach me. I'm too fast, Dan.
Nathan and Fond du Lac.
I love you guys. It was your comments about Pritzker is hilarious. The lies that they predicate all of this on, the Democratic Party and their evil speak,
And they talk about protecting kids. Well, why are you lying to them? I've never seen science change every other week like I have this past year.
It's a cold.
And it is just one lie after another. How can they make these decisions or these scientific changes so rapidly? So you lie to your kids, you lie to everybody, you instill fear, you play your games, and it's all about the policies they want to implement, and we'll put a noose around your neck one way or the other, but we're going to hold you to it until we get what we want. And it's evident to see what the hell they're doing.
Thanks, Nathan. Appreciate it. Candace in Mount Pleasant.
Thanks for taking my call. You know what was disturbing about that? Yesterday I saw that woman. But here's what bothers me about it, Dan, and I'm with you. If somebody says something to me about the mask, I'm going to say exactly what you said. Mind your fracking business.
And also say, why don't you come put it on me? Or try
Ooh,
to.
I love that part,
that's a good
too.
One, too. Yeah,
it
my birthday, Dan Classic.
Home Depot. Yeah. It almost happened to me at Home Depot, but I don't care. I've been to
and
Home
be carrying
Depot
a bloody axe when you say it. Yes. I'm sorry. Go
ahead. Okay. Listen, what bothers me about the lady yesterday is school board. First of all, I don't think that we should have school boards because it's a bureaucracy between the teacher and the parents, and they shouldn't get that. So I think that should be defunded and gone. But why is she asking? She's asking and begging. She should have said, this is what's going to happen, and this is what I'm going to organize. Stop asking. She's like begging. I hate that.
I know. Thanks for the call, Candace. I know, but I mean, it's the, for the parent. I mean, I want to give some aid and comfort here for the parent. I mean, I can't send my 6-year-old to school and have him not wear a mask, and then what put him in the crosshairs? What he's got to fight with the teachers about his mask,
and he'll get shamed by the kids,
or he gets sent home, and you know, so it's mom versus the machine here. So, but just, I thought Ms. Taylor was pretty forceful, pretty effective. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning. You know, interestingly, you know, John Tamney, I know you've had him on the show.
Yeah.
And he talks about how this stuff would not have happened 20 years ago. These lockdowns, these mask mandates, this wouldn't have happened because of the technology and so forth. It wasn't possible for us to do all this stuff. But I also think it wouldn't have happened, you know, years ago, 30, 40 years ago, because the greatest generation would have never done this.
No.
You know, these people, many of these people are just quizlings. They really are. No. You know, they're the kinds of people, you know, who... we're eminently invadable right now. We really are. I mean, if we had some country invade us, what would these leaders that we have do? Would they just all accommodate them like Quisling did in Norway? That's what I feel about. That's how I feel about these people. Some of them are just so utterly pathetic.
We'd set up an autonomous zone and say, hey, you can't come in here.
We would. I drove by Fairview School yesterday, Amy, and I was driving down there by the field, and, the kids were out there, and, you know, it was just horrible what they looked like with the masks. It really did.
It's horrible.
So, I mean,
And then there's like, maskne that's so bad. It's just so bad.
What planet am I living on?
Well, it makes no sense because they sit there, they make them wear them for sports, and they just sweat through their masks. And when your masks are soaking wet with sweat, they're not working.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. When Governor Greg Abbott of Texas lifted the statewide face mask mandate down there, that was in early March. It was called Neanderthal thinking by one President Joe Biden.
Oh, yeah.
A month and a half later, newly identified coronavirus cases in Texas have fallen by more than 50%. Daily deaths have dropped even more precipitously than that. Meanwhile, in states lorded over by lockdowners, like, say, the Eva Peron of East Lansing there in Michigan, states with stricter COVID-19 regulations have seen spikes in daily new cases. Not the pattern you would expect to see if government-imposed restrictions played a crucial role in curtailing the pandemic, as the lockdowners continue to advocate. How does one explain that other than that those proposing the lockdowns are wrong, at least in terms of what they think, based on public statements, that they're doing, that they think they're going to accomplish? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined again by Professor Martin Kulldorff. He's a professor at Harvard Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital as well. Professor, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Surprised that the mask mandate didn't kill Texans and Texas lifting it?
No, I'm not surprised. And actually, as a history buff, I think the Neanderthals are pretty cool. And I like Texans also. So I think that's pretty good.
And yet there's been a fivefold increase since March 1 in Michigan. Maine has seen a nearly threefold increase. Minnesota has seen a doubling. So what's happening in those northeastern and midwestern states that's not happening in, say, like Texas or Florida?
Well, for example, Maine never had had among the lowest from before. So it will come to each place sooner or later. So it came later to Maine. While Texas has a lot of immunity, mostly from natural infections, but also from vaccines a little bit now in the last few months.
And so, the thinking about this both retrospectively and prospectively, you know, as we stand here today, what should we understand about this continuing debate that rages about mask mandates for K through 12 kids? Lockdown policies that will gradually allow for indoor this and indoor that, you know, a very slow walk towards something resembling pre-pandemic America.
Well, putting masks on children is not a good thing. There's no public health evidence that it would work, and there are detrimental effects of doing it. So that's not a good policy. Children are not at risk for this disease, less risk than annual influenza, and they don't spread it very much. So there's absolutely no reason to put masks on children, and I think it's more harmful than beneficial, for sure.
But don't you think it would be good to, you know, as a way to, an incentive to get a vaccine, if the CDC said, yes, if you've been double vaccinated and waited 14 days, you do not have to wear a mask anymore? Do you ever see that happening in the near future?
I think that certainly there's no reason for people who are vaccinated and people who have had COVID to wear a mask, that there's no sense to that. And if CDC has changed their policy to do that, that's fantastic.
Well, we want them to.
Yeah, if they would, right. This piece that you and Jay Bhattacharya wrote for the Journal just a couple weeks back, in part, you wrote, the idea that everybody needs to be vaccinated is as scientifically basis as the idea that nobody does. COVID vaccines are essential for older, high-risk people and their caretakers and advisable for many others. Tyler Cohen, who's an economist over at George Mason, responded to that statement from the joint op-ed that you and Bhattacharya published. I wonder why he, you and Jay, cannot bring himself to say the average social value of a 16-year-old getting vaccinated is strongly positive. Instead, he has to walk around the issue and play down the value of near-universal COVID vaccination. So he's suggesting that, younger people are less at risk than older people, but there's still a positive correlation societally for having 16-year-olds, for example, get vaccinated. So why not say that and push universal vaccination?
Well, I don't think that's clear that that's the case. I don't think children need to be vaccinated. They are not at risk for this disease, as we said, and having it naturally, most of them are asymptomatic, and others only mildly symptomatic, and we still don't know very much about the adverse reactions to these vaccines. We know a little bit now, but so for older people, there's a clear benefit, and every young person, every 16-year-old who gets this vaccine means that an older person, either in the U.S. or in the rest of the world, will not get it because there's still a shortage of vaccines. So it's better to wait with younger adults like that, and Maybe at some point we know more, so we know what the cost-benefit ratios are. But at this point, I don't think we do know that. But the key thing now is to vaccinate older people. They are the ones who are at risk of dying from this disease, and they need vaccinations.
Well, starting today in Chicago and in the state of Illinois, now you can just walk in. If you have a 16-year-old and older, you can just walk into any place and get a vaccine. You don't have to get an appointment. So I don't think we have a vaccine shortage here. But I know that around the world, there is, like, my friend from Utrecht, Holland, is coming in Monday, flying in to get a vaccine, because she doesn't even know anybody who's been vaccinated in her community. Why is there such a shortage there in Europe compared to the U.S.?
Well, the U.S. and the U.K. have had a lot of vaccinations, but there's a shortage in other parts of Europe, and there's a shortage in Latin America, Africa, and Asia. And public health is something that is global. We have to think about it globally. So there's a lot of older people in other countries who have not been vaccinated. And we have to help them and make sure that they can get vaccinated, because otherwise a lot of people will die.
Well, right. I mean, perhaps most urgently, what's happening in India with the exponential increase in cases there. And obviously this is that a lot of India is densely populated. It's poor. I think it's one of the world leaders in air and water pollution. So you have all sorts of problems there. So rather than worrying about vaccinating your 9-year-old, we should be global citizens, like we're always, like some of those lockdowners always talk about us being, and focus on areas where you could really have a public health crisis like India.
Exactly.
Well, and so. The Great Barrington Declaration crew, you and Professor Gupta and Professor Bhattacharya, how do you guys think that you've stood up over the last year in terms of how you conceive this and you know, versus everybody else trying to get their hands around it, and how you've adjusted based on what we're understanding, both from research and real-world experience, and also how you've adjusted or not adjusted to all the criticism you've received from sort of the established orthodoxy on COVID policy?
Well, I think we have been proven right that these lockdowns were not effective in protecting the older high-risk people. And because people thought they would protect them, the other standard public health measures that would have really prevent the disease in the older people were never implemented. And that's very tragic, I think. And that's why we have over 500,000 deaths in the United States, because we didn't properly protect older, high-risk people. So I think we've been vindicated. The one thing that sort of changed when we wrote the Great Barrington Declaration in October, there were no vaccines, and we didn't know when or if the vaccines would be coming. So when the vaccines came, it became, of course, obvious that vaccine was a primary way to protect the older people. And it was important to quickly vaccinate as many of the old people as possible, as well as, for example, nursing home staff, so that they don't infect the residents.
So today the CDC is going to announce that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, after a two-week pause, is all of a sudden safe again, and they're going to be starting to administer those shots. But what were the dangers of pausing the J&J vaccine?
Well, I don't know if we know what CDC will decide, because the ACIP, Advisory Committee of Immunization Practices, is meeting today to take a vote. But there was an issue of a very rare blood clot disease in the brain among younger people. There were 6 women all below the age of 50. So that was the real adverse reaction. And there are better than alternative for young people to take the Pfizer or Moderna. But there was no evidence for increased risk in the older people. So until there are increased risk for older people, it's sort of as damaging vaccine confidence to do to temporarily withdraw this vaccine. And it means that a lot of old people would not have gotten it. And while anybody can go in and get the vaccine in most parts in the United States now, there are still many old people who haven't gotten it, and especially among the more vulnerable, less affluent people. There needs to be a better outreach, and the J&J vaccine is very important for them, because one shot is enough, so they don't have to come back. So it's an ideal vaccine for those who are harder to reach older people. that won't sort of come to an appointment 3 or 4 weeks later to get the second shot.
He is Martin Kulldorff. He is a professor at Harvard Medical School, as well as Brigham and Young and Brigham and Women's Hospital, that is. Professor Kulldorff, thanks again for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Always my pleasure.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Their call for unity is a joke.
News.
Important question is not whether you're right or they're right, but why we shouldn't have the right to flip the channel.
Fuels. Opinion.
We have got to stop making it a crime to be a Republican.
News. Opinion. Insight. On AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So according to Micaiah Bryant's foster mom, Micaiah Bryant is the 16-year-old girl who was shot and killed by police in Columbus, Ohio. We've been talking about the last couple days. According to her foster mom, the argument started between Micaiah and other foster children that she had fostered who came over to celebrate her birthday.
Oh.
The argument started between the girls about making the bed. Mom doesn't like things dirty. That escalated into an argument that escalated somehow into what we saw in that video. And there's a new video out that has the reverse angle on it from a neighbor named Donovan Bryson, who, by the way, says basically the police, and he is a black gentleman, the police were right to do what they did because she was going to kill that girl. That was his perspective. Donovan Brinson, I should say, is the neighbor's name. Here's that video, and what you get on this that you didn't get on the body cam video is what Micaiah Bryant said as she was chasing girls with a knife. I'm going to stab the blank F out of you, B. Right.
Yeah, you can hear it there. Yep.
That's what she said. And so this becomes a little bit more complicated, particularly when you have plaintiff's attorneys like Benjamin Crump saying out of the gate that a 16-year-old girl was shot and killed who was unarmed. Well, she wasn't unarmed. And by the way, the girl who was on the hood of the car when she raised that knife and seemed pretty intent on plunging it into that girl, also a black girl, also a black teenager, said, yeah, she was going to stab me, so police got her.
But a police officer should be held as a hero.
We'll see if that becomes the prevailing narrative. I'm somewhat skeptical. For more on all of this and the context of the Chauvin conviction, as well as what continues to transpire and the degradation of the standards that continues unabated, pleased to be joined again by Gerard Baker, editor-at-large, Wall Street Journal. Gerard, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I'm a little concerned about you because I understand you've been following Chelsea Handler's Twitter feed, and that is not healthy.
Yeah. I know, I'm going into therapy for it. It is slightly addictive. Yes, I wrote my column this week about, not about Chelsea Handler, but about what I describe as the Chelsea Handler standard, really, among progressives now in terms of how we should view criminal cases. You'll recall, I think it did sort of go viral, unfortunately. It didn't deserve to, but it went viral that Chelsea Handler tweeted at the start of the Derek Chauvin trial, she tweeted something along the lines of, why do we need to have a trial? Everybody can see the video. We saw it. We should just deal with it. We don't need a trial. Now, it's easy to pick on idiotic things that Chelsea Handler says because she says so many of them, and it's not much of a career to build your writing career around Chelsea Handler tweets. But my point was not to poke fun at Chelsea Handler, but to point to the larger problem, which is that progressives and most of the Democratic Party, unfortunately, do seem to kind of subscribe to this. And of course, then I went on to talk about Maxine Waters. This is the view that why do we need the view that many of them have is the legal system is corrupt, is unfair, produces bad outcomes, is racist. The whole system is racist. I mean, you know, Joe Biden's out there immediately after the verdict saying, you know, we have systemic racism. Their argument really is that Maxine Waters was out there basically saying it on Sunday night when she said, you know, if we don't get the verdict we want, we're going to get more confrontational. Their view of the legal system is the Chelsea Handler view of the legal system, which is we don't need trials and lawyers and presumption of innocence and burden of proof and, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt and all that stuff. We will tell you what's right and what's wrong. We'll tell you what the case is. And and their basic view is, since the system is unjust and racist, then, you know, it can't be fair. And that's a problem, frankly. And you saw it again. Look, the verdict, yeah. The jury came to the verdict. I watched the trial. A lot of it, I thought the evidence was quite compelling. I think you can have legitimate concerns about what was going on around the trial with people like Maxine Waters and the president and others. But look, they came to the verdict. I think most people I know accept that verdict. They think that the jury came to the right verdict. And that's the way the legal system is supposed to work. But if you have a system where people only accept the legal system if it delivers the verdict that they want, then you've got a problem.
Well, the other thing, too, is, you know, it's one thing to laugh off Chelsea Handler. It's another thing when a municipal official like the mayor of Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, almost substantively takes that very position and makes it policy, firing the city manager and the police chief for suggesting that the officer involved in the Dante Wright shooting she needs to get due process. The idea that you just sort of willy-nilly, you know, I mean, I get this is where the left is, to your point. They willy-nilly ignore the Constitution. They want to make D.C. a state. They willy-nilly ignore the Constitution and due process when it suits them. And it's really a remarkable thing because I guess my question would be, okay, well, then what are we replacing it with?
No, exactly. I mean, look, this is, you know, again, so look, I don't think all Democrats necessarily think this way, but the prevailing ideology in the Democratic Party, which seems to have many of them basically convinced, is we've talked about this before, but it's this sort of critical race theory, which is based essentially in Marxist interpretations of society, and the Marxist view is that you can't kind of consider individuals. As individuals, you have to see them as part of a larger social grouping, a larger identity. And in the old Marxist format, it was like the capitalist exploiters versus the working class, right? Well, that didn't work because actually the working class turned out to do well under capitalism, and a lot of people liked it in capitalism, and that kind of, and communism and that version of Marxism collapsed. This has come back now in the form of this critical race theory, where instead of capitalists and the working class, capitalists and the exploited, it's white people fundamentally and the oppressed, who are blacks and to some extent other minorities, and they take the same view then all of the structures that we have in place, this is the basis of the theory, all the structures that we have in place, the political system, the judicial system, the constitution, capitalism, everything that we created is fundamentally illegitimate because it is the product of white supremacy. It's the product of the oppressor classes oppressing down on minorities. And therefore, you can't necessarily accept as legitimate the proceedings of what those institutions do. So that's the problem. So you know, again, I went on to talk in the column about, you know, what Marxists wanted to do was create these sort of proletarian courts. And I think, you know, you make that very good point about the you know, whoever it was in Brooklyn Center who basically said, you fired someone for saying someone should get due process. That's we are close to a situation here where people want mob justice. I mean, look at, you know, so again, you know, you can argue about the Chauvin trial. There is an argument that was a form of mob justice, right? Because the jury were very clear in their minds, I think, that if they came to the quote-unquote wrong verdict, then the country would explode. Look at, you just talked about this this terrible case of this Makia Bryant girl. Look at the way the left immediately seized on that before any facts were known to condemn that police officer. Look what Kobe, look, sorry, look what LeBron James did.
Right.
You know, in this, posting a photograph of that cop on Twitter saying, "You're next." That's mob justice. That's the kind of justice I think that a lot of these people want. They don't want to hear that, you know, actually that cop acted out of incredible, actually acted to save the life of somebody else. He acted with bravery. He did exactly what he should have done. As far as we can tell, all the videos we've seen that have come out suggest that he saved that other girl's life and that he did what he had to do. But that doesn't matter.
But the professional agitators need a cause. They need, you know, they need to drum up something. So where are they going to go from Minneapolis? They're not going to go home and go, you know, take a week off. They need somewhere else to go. So don't you think they're naturally going to move over to Columbus, Ohio?
Yeah, they are. And the next one and the next one, you know, they will move on. You know, and again, and this is not, you know, it's easy to, again, even it's even easy maybe to poke fun at the Chelsea Handler or LeBron James. Remember after the, you know, the initial White House response after that Makia Bryant death, the official response, which Jen Psaki read from the White House press room podium, talked about black people being victims of police violence. It expressed great sympathy and for a child, as it described her, who'd been killed. And it went on to talk about police violence. That's from the White House. That's from the President of the United States. That's not, you know, some stupid comedian who thinks she's funny, or from some, you know, basketball player who makes tens of millions of dollars by playing to Chinese, by taking money from the Chinese government and their sponsors, who happily, while they're happily oppressing people. That is from the President of the United States immediately leaping to the accusation of police violence. What kind of justice is that? When the President of the United States weighs in immediately, completely falsely accusing a police officer of committing in an isolated way of committing police violence. That's the justice they want.
He is Gerard Baker. He's editor-at-large, Wall Street Journal. Check out his latest piece. We were discussing in part the Chauvin trial and the Chelsea Handler standard of justice. Gerard, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, they got all kinds of innovative policing ideas up in Minnesota. We talked earlier in the program, as we have previously, about the George Floyd Autonomous Zone.
Yeah.
How violent that sacred space is, as Gail King terms it. Also this, Minnesota's Police Licensing Board yesterday agreed to pursue new rules for law enforcement responses to protests and impose a ban on officers affiliating with white supremacist groups.
Huh?
As a police officer in Minnesota, you're not allowed to affiliate with white supremacist groups. Hooray, right? Or
has it been a problem?
Well, isn't that one of the implications? Isn't that one of the premises of such a move?
We've got a
white supremacy problem with Minnesota police officers, so we need to ban their affiliations with white supremacist groups. Really, you have a bunch of skinheads on the police forces in Minneapolis communities. Number one, that's number one. Number two, there is no definition of what constitutes a white supremacist group. So I don't know. Up in Minnesota, that's probably, and for those authors of this ban, they probably would consider the Republican Party a white supremacist group, because certainly all the elected officials in Minnesota do, don't they? Okay. All right.
And did we talk about this, that they deemed the, you know, the congressional baseball shooting as a suicide by cop? I mean, suicide by cop, the shooter, who was from Illinois, by the way, who was a Barry Sanders supporter, hid from police.
Bernie Sanders, excuse me.
He wanted to kill. I mean, he had a list. It just minimizes what those congressional members went through.
Yeah, it's also, I don't know. I haven't seen any evidence he knew that Steve Scalise would be there, and thus he knew there would be a Capitol police detail with Steve Scalise, because that's the only reason those members of Congress are alive today.
Yeah, and this was not suicide by police.
I'm surprised they didn't say it was, you know, the Republican Party's white supremacist tendencies prompted this, you know, this good-hearted but misguided Bernie Sanders supporter or some such thing. Everything is forced through a racial prism.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Mondaire Jones is a newly minted member of Congress. He's from New York. A young man, 33 years old. He is black, he is gay, and he is a proponent of intersectionality and all of the identitarian politics associated with the Democrat Socialist Party in 2021 America. He took to the well of the House to speak on behalf of D.C. statehood, which, as we know, passed out of the House. We'll see what kind of treatment it gets in the Senate. Here's how he characterized the importance of D.C. statehood and the opposition to it.
Mr. Speaker, I have had enough of my colleagues' racist insinuations that somehow the people of Washington, D.C. are incapable or even unworthy of our democracy. One Senate Republican said that D.C. wouldn't be a, quote, well-rounded working-class state. I had no idea there were so many syllables in the word white. One of my House Republican colleagues said that D.C. shouldn't be a state because the district doesn't have a landfill. My goodness, with all the racist trash my colleagues have brought to this debate, I can see why they're worried about having a place to put it. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The truth is, there is no good faith argument for disenfranchising over 700,000 people, most of whom are people of color. These desperate objections are about fear. Fear that in D.C. their white supremacist politics will no longer play. Fear that soon enough white supremacist politics won't work anywhere in America. Fear that if they don't rig our democracy, they will not win. Today, Democrats are standing up for a multiracial democracy. To democratize all 51 states in this country, I yield back.
He is a critical race theorist par excellence. He must have learned it at Harvard Law School, where that oppressed member of Congress graduated after getting his undergraduate degree at Stanford in this oppressive America where black Americans don't have opportunity. For more on the topic of the philosophy behind politicians like Mondaire Jones, pleased to be joined by Alana Redstone. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Illinois in Champaign, co-author of Unassailable Ideas, How Uncertain Rules and Social Media Shape Discourse in American Higher Education, and creator of the Beyond Bigots and Snowflakes video series. That's a great title for snow. I like that. She wrote a great piece in Tablet, which caught my attention, Conflict Theory Doesn't Like You. It's a great primer on basically how we are so critical race theory obsessed, why it is part of the curriculum in so many schools. We talk a lot about it here, the basis for it, the philosophical basis for it. Professor Redstone, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So Representative Jones seems to me gave a good example of what you write about in your piece and sort of illustrate with the black person and white person in an elevator. There's other reasons to oppose D.C. statehood, especially in the way that Democrats are trying to do it with a simple majority vote of Congress. Many would argue, myself included, that if you want to make D.C. a state, you can do it, but it requires a constitutional amendment, not a majority vote of the House and Senate. So that's one reason you could be opposed to it, but he doesn't want to focus on those reasons. He wants to focus on identitarian reasons. And so your elevator example for illustration.
Right. Do you want me to talk through the example?
Yeah, please.
Yeah. So in the piece, first of all, let me just a couple things just really quick. I'll just be clear. I'm not an expert on D.C. statehood or the arguments there. And I can
I understand.
To speak to sort of the broader issues. And the book is actually, it's How Unwritten Rules, Not Uncertain Rules. So just a short correction No, that's okay. No problem. So the example that I use in the article and the piece is called Conflict Theory Doesn't Like You. And so which is a I was glad with the glad about the title, which I did not choose. Oftentimes, as probably you already know, we don't pick the titles. But the example was basically if you have two people on an elevator and one person gets so let's I can't remember the exact which one gets on the elevator and which one was already there. But the idea is that if there's somebody already on the elevator, let's say, for example, there's a black woman who's already on the elevator and she gets on at the second floor or she was on since the second floor and somebody else gets on at the third floor. And let's say it's just for the sake of argument, let's say it's a white woman and the white woman who gets on at the third floor doesn't greet the black woman who's already on the elevator. And so one way of interpreting what I say in the article is that one way of interpreting that is that, you know, is through the lens of power dynamics and that sort of the white woman who gets on is doesn't sort of see the other, doesn't see the woman who's already on the elevator as sort of worthy of her attention or time in a way that she can just kind of, you know, rebuff any greeting or sort of just not paying attention. And that that's driven by some subconscious or conscious sense of racial animus. And so what I point out in the article is that that's, you know, I couldn't sit here and tell you that that is impossible. Of course, it's, that is a possible explanation, but that it's not the only possible explanation. And so, you know, and what I want to, again, in the article, I sort of say, well, you know, maybe the woman just, maybe she's having a rough day. Maybe she's claustrophobic. Maybe she's, you know, lost in thought, you know, who all these other things that could be going on. But there's this assumption that's made about how, what, when those interactions don't work out, when those interactions go sideways, particularly when they're between members of different identity groups, that the assumption is that it's because of those identity group memberships. And the problem is that you have these competing explanations and you can't, there's no empirical way to sort of rule one out definitively or say, you know, I'm positive it's this or I'm positive it's this. So it sort of comes back to this question of what your default assumptions are and how you want to evaluate competing explanations. And through critical race theory and conflict theory more generally, it's always going to point you toward the direction that says that the identity is the explanation. And I think that that's, I imagine sometimes it's true and sometimes it's not, but it doesn't allow for that range of the human experience and sort of all of the other things that contribute to our social interactions.
Yeah, I like the phrase you described. I think this is really elegant in describing conflict theory in one sentence. It looks into the room of social problems and shines a giant spotlight on a single aspect of the human condition, yet leaves the rest of the room dark.
Right, right. I think that's true. You know, and it's interesting because you could say, someone could easily make the argument, they could say, well, you know, doesn't every theory do that? And to some extent, I think that's true. I think that is actually true. And particularly in the social sciences, I think the problem is that when you get this expansion and this sort of, it's this, you know, theory that we, you know, then it becomes a hammer and we're looking for a nail and we're using it to explain everything rather than, you know, yeah, this is one way to look at it. And here's some other, right, sort of putting it in this broader context, which I think is where we need to be. And that's not, unfortunately, where we are.
And the evolution or devolution to where we are, you go back to Marx and the bourgeois versus the proletariat, bourgeoisie versus the proletariat. And it seems to me now what has happened is folks have figured out that making these sorts of claims and reducing everything to a binary is a good way to political power. And if we can't do it through sort of economic class warfare, then maybe we can do it through racial warfare.
You know, I don't know. I'm not sure I would characterize it quite that way, because at some level, that's also making an assumption about intent, about some sort of, you know, sinister intent as with a power grab. And again, there may be some of that. Well, I mean, you know, I try to not read into other people's intent. So, but it's certainly possible, you know, but I think that a lot of it is driven by people who are generally concerned about members of marginalized groups and the harm that the perceived harm. And I mean, I think, but part of what's happened is, you know, again, an expansion of terms and this sort of concept creep that comes along with it, including ideas about harm, including, you know, expansion of how we think about racism. And so suddenly these terms themselves mean different things to different people in a way that makes it really hard to even have a conversation.
Well, right. I mean, okay, so setting aside intent, I mean, you will concede, yeah, it seems you did in your piece, that, I mean, there is, it's incredibly myopic. I mean, and to your, yeah, point, and to the human, human interaction is layered and complicated and textured. I get on the elevator and I don't acknowledge somebody of a different race because I don't acknowledge anybody because I don't like acknowledging people on the elevator. I'm uncomfortable.
Right.
You know, I mean,
right,
that's
true story.
So, right, but everything becomes that about the racial dynamic, if it's two people of a different race, and then it's immediately set on fire in so many instances. And also you have K through 12 school systems and the academy essentially adopting that myopic view and suggesting people who don't share that myopic view, who offer an alternative theory, are not being anti-racist, to borrow from Ibram, right, Kendi, and thus then are racist.
Right. And so actually now with the book that you mentioned, the Unassailable Ideas book, that's actually really a lot of the premise of that book, which is that in that book, we talk about essentially three kind of unwritten rules or unspoken beliefs that underpin a lot of the entire academic endeavor. And we also talk in that book about how they're sort of propped up by direct and indirect effects of social media. But the whole point in that book is kind of what you're saying, which is that, look, these are a set of beliefs. They're a particular, they're problematic when you assume everyone has them or should have them. And it's problematic when you treat them as though they're factual. But their existence, at least the position that my co-author and I take in the book, it's not that their existence. So, for example, my own position is that, I think, yes, we should be teaching conflict theory. Teach it and teach critical race theory, but yeah, teach it in a way that is contextualized and that doesn't swap it out as a factual presentation of how the world works. And so, again, it is a social science theory, and it should be sort of held up to the light and criticized as any other should be.
Right. And so what has happened in the academy where that is not allowable in so many places? Of course, I mean, I learned about I'm not a Marxist, and I learned about Marxism, sure, and Gramsci in high school and college and so forth, and again bumped up against other theorists and other philosophies and other economic theories, and then you hash it out. And so that is increasingly not allowed, particularly with respect to certain theories like those advanced by the Ibram Kendis and Robin DiAngelos of the world. Why has the academy bought that?
I've never held an administrative role in academia. I've sort of always been I've always been on the faculty, and I've not been an administrator. Why have they bought it? I don't know. I don't.
Well, the professorate.
I think there are a lot of reasons. What?
Yeah. Your colleagues, the professorate. So many people essentially subscribe to that, too, that they're unwilling to consider alternative theories or criticism of that theory in particular.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's complicated. I mean, I think there's a longer answer that maybe longer than your audience is willing to sit for. I think it has to do with the expansion, sort of over in the latter half of the 20th century, sort of expansion of how we think. I mean, I've written about this elsewhere, and how we think about racism and, and how and why the expansion of the way that's measured changed, and sort of that corresponded and coincided with this whole influx of critical theory. But the whole issue, I mean, you sort of put your finger on it already in different words, which is that, all of the critical theory approaches, and critical race theory in particular, as it's tied to anti-racism, capital A, capital R, in terms of the movement associated with Kendi and such, is that, the assumption is that there is, again, and this goes back to what you were saying about DC statehood, is that there is no alternative perspective that is on equal moral footing. That sits underneath all of it. And so that's kind of in my own work and with students, is to try and raise questions about that. Because if you can get there, then you can open up the conversation and say, let's open this up. Like there is, and so there are ways to do that, with groups and with students and things like that. But that's sort of, the a piece of this that underlies all of it, which is, again, that this idea that there are there's more than one perspective that can exist on equal moral footing. I see that as key.
How do your students at U of I receive that sort of setup, for how we're going to address and tackle these competing theories?
You know, I think so. There's two classes really where I bring this up. One is, and this is, you know, the video series is Beyond Bigots and Snowflakes, but that's actually came from a class that I teach called Bigots and Snowflakes. And so I'm teaching that now for the third time. You know, I think, and on the other place where it comes up is I teach a class called Social Problems, which is, you know, more general. But it comes up in both places. I think that the way that I've found to present, to sort of start these conversations is really from a place of asking questions. And I think it is generally well received. I'm not trying to make an argument. So, for example, if you wanted to talk about, you know, race-based college admissions or something like that, one of these very sort of volatile topics, you know, you could say to students, and this is what I've done, is you could say, you know, well, why might somebody oppose or have concerns about race-based college admissions? And, well, because they're racist. Okay, so we can put that on our list. You know, and you could even imagine an actual list if you're in a classroom with a chalkboard. You know, and then you can say, well, is there any other reason why somebody might, you know, oppose or have concerns about this idea of race-based college admissions? And usually when I've done this exercise, usually there are a couple of other things that end up on that list, you know, 2, 3, 4 other things. And then the question is, well, if all you know about somebody is that they're opposed to race-based college admissions, can you tell which of these reasons is sort of their motivating factor? What's driving their position? And of course, you can't in the absence of any other information. And so then the question is, well, what does it mean to get it wrong? What does it mean if we get it wrong a lot? And so those are conversation questions that aren't arguing, you know, I'm not taking a position and trying to convince people to change their minds. I'm just saying, look, this is how we talk and think about it. And that itself goes against, I mean, this isn't necessarily my goal, but it's sort of part of the whole thing. It goes against the whole anti-racism critical race theory. I mean, because you can't, the idea, but that's the question, is that, you know, can there be other reasons to have these concerns or to take these positions that are, again, this idea on equal moral footing? And it's hard, because the reality is that you're putting these reasons, they look the same to somebody who is, you know, sort of an advocate of anti-racism, for example. The person who takes the position against, to just stay with the earlier example, race-based college admissions, the person is driven by racial animus, and the person who's driven by some really principled concern about the sort of allocation of admissions and whatever, and allocation of resources, they look the same. And so that, you know, economists call it observational equivalence. But that, those competing explanations, that's hard. And so thinking through with students and with groups, sort of, well, you know, okay, yes, we can recognize that that's hard, but how do you want to respond to that? And how do you want to evaluate, evaluate that situation? I think that that's been a fairly useful approach.
I got a great example for your class. Now, you don't have to use it.
Okay.
I'm not forcing this on your syllabus, but the Cruz Amendment to the anti-hate crime legislation that recently passed, the anti-Asian hate crime legislation that recently passed. Cruz Amendment was to prohibit federal funding for any institution of higher education that discriminates against Asian Americans in recruitment, applicant review, or admissions. Okay, that was the amendment. 49 Republicans, all of the Republicans, voted yes to prohibit federal funding for that sort of discrimination. 48 Democrats, all Democrats who voted on it, voted no. Explain. Right? Wouldn't that be fun? Wouldn't that be a fun thought exercise?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't actually think, I'm not opposed to it. I mean, I'd have to first, you know, do my own due diligence about sort of the amendment and everything, but I don't think it's a bad idea. So maybe I will incorporate it.
All right. If it gets into your
class. Yeah, but I mean, again, it's sort of getting them to think about things more broadly.
Yes. Right. And if it gets into your class, do I get college credit for that?
I'm happy to give you credit.
He
I don't
needs
know.
Credit.
I don't, I'm
he
not
needs
the arbiter
one more
of credit.
Credit.
No, I'm kidding. I'm
you
kidding.
Need one more credit. I wish I
yeah,
had
one,
power. I don't
one
have
credit short. Right. One.
Right.
Professor
have a
Alana.
A life-changing degree.
Yes. Right. Professor Alana Redstone. She's a professor of sociology at the U of I, The book, Unassailable Ideas, How Unwritten Rules and Social Media Shape Discourse in American Higher Education. And do check out her piece at Tablet, which I'll tweet out, Conflict Theory Doesn't Like You. Also, her video series, Beyond Bigots and Snowflakes, Beyond Bigots and Snowflakes video series. Professor Redstone, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much. All right, take care.
Thanks. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, like those lording over the George Floyd Autonomous Zone in Minneapolis, who issued a list of 24 demands yesterday. The House Democrat and Senate Democrat Socialist caucuses have their list of demands when it comes to policing in America, and that's largely memorialized in that policing bill that Biden spoke about after the Chauvin verdict earlier this week, where he really essentially characterized the police as a predatory institution. So just because it hasn't happened, something that's happened in Minneapolis or Brooklyn Center or Chicago, hasn't happened in your community yet, there is a push to federalize, through the Department of Justice and through the legislation proposed, policing in this country. It's not going to happen in function, but it could happen in form. And that's something that raises some concerns, should raise some concerns no matter where you live, on issues like qualified immunity that would change the way policing can be done at the local level, even if Merrick Garland isn't watching what you're doing. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Susan Crabtree, RealClearPolitics.com's White House and national political correspondent. Susan, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great to be there with you.
The sticking points between, you know, because Tim Scott obviously proposed a policing reform, Republican senator from South Carolina, last year, some policing reform legislation that wouldn't get the light of day from Democrats because, as Chuck Schumer said, he's a token, or that's just token. And so the sticking points, the real sticking points in terms of any sort of legislation akin to what has been proposed by Biden making its way into law.
Yeah, well, it's this, mainly this qualified immunity that you mentioned. And that is it's actually not in the law itself. It's a tradition that the Supreme Court, as a precedent, the Supreme Court has established over many, many years. And so states right now are realizing there's so much gridlock in Washington on that, and some of the more liberal states are doing it themselves and basically changing qualified immunity to make it more people able to sue cops and then make them personally liable in some cases for the damages involved. And so this is a huge debate that's playing out in the states because it's not going anywhere in Washington, because there's not the 10 Republicans that will require it to reach above the filibuster 60-vote threshold. Democrats don't have that. And so it was very, very strange on the night of the Chauvin verdict that Joe Biden was talking to the Floyd family and he was promising them, I mean, it was just an outright promise that he was going to get the bill passed, the George Floyd bill with the qualified immunity in it. But now we see Tim Scott, just in the past 24 hours, he has been working with Democrat Representative Karen Bass and Senator Cory Booker, and to produce a compromise bill. I don't know what it's going to stipulate about qualified immunity. I have a feeling that he's going to at least provide some limits. He's going to have to acquiesce to that because that is the big issue that Democrats want. But it'll be really interesting because next week, as you know, is we call it the State of the Union. That's really technically the first joint address to Congress because it's President Biden's first address. So you can't really comment on the State of the Union yet. Technically, that's what it's called. And And Senator Scott is going to be provide the Republican response to that address.
Right.
So the Republicans are putting him out there as they know that he is the Republican answer on police reform while he's working with Democrats on a compromise bill.
I wanted to also tackle this piece that you wrote up on an issue that's not as front and center, perhaps should be, and that's the American policy towards religious freedom abroad. And Samantha Power, another Obama administration veteran that has made her way back into the federal government, her position, and she was former U.S. ambassador and so forth. And what the Biden posture towards religious freedom is the world over, this is particularly acute when you think about Uyghur Muslims as well as Christians being persecuted by the Chinese communists. And there's sort of a subtle but important massaging America away from preeminent concerns with religious freedom. It's just sort of another human right in the panoply of human rights as so broadly defined by folks like Joe Biden.
Yes, this is an issue I've been following very closely because the Trump administration, they really worked hard on to make religious freedom a big priority of their foreign policy, and they were constantly up against the sort of bureaucratic gridlock in Washington and bias against religion among the State Department career folks and USAID, that Agency for International Development. The career folks there have a religious blind policy. They don't believe that, even though we have said never again to the Holocaust and other genocides, they don't think that the people who suffer from persecution, religious freedom persecution, should be given priority in terms of funding and where our attention goes. We thought that the Biden administration, a lot of the advocates I talked to, and activists and former Trump officials were giving him the benefit of the doubt at first. Wrote a story back in December, saying, you know, we believe that Antony Blinken's going to be Secretary of State, and he has spoken out against about his father's experience in fleeing the Holocaust and coming to America and being saved by an American member of the Army during the Holocaust. So we feel like he's going to give this religious freedom issue its just cause. Well, no, it seems like that anything that Trump does is they're going to try to repudiate that. And that's the word that he chose, Antony Blinken, on March 30th, when he undid Pompeo's, this Commission on Inalienable Rights. And basically said the Trump administration took an unbalanced view towards religious freedom, so we're not going to be doing that at all. We are going to repudiate that, and we are going to take a different tack and value all human rights equally, including LGBTQ rights, women's reproductive rights. So he put it in a whole panoply of rights. But just because you're experiencing genocide doesn't mean that the Americans need to do anything about it to stop it, which is kind of contrary to what the policies have been so far with the Uyghur Muslims. They got on board. They got in on the way out the door. The Trump administration, Mike Pompeo, made a designation for the Uyghurs that it was genocide, and they actually abided by that when the Biden administration came in. But now we're seeing this word choice of repudiation, and I think it signals that changes are definitely in the works, and we've already seen summary of religious freedom contract, one particularly in Nigeria, that was supposed to be aimed at documenting genocide there against Christians and some Muslims, and Boko Haram and Fulani militias being the perpetrators. We're already seeing that contract being canceled and a hold put on any religious freedom contract from the Trump administration.
And it's also additionally ironic, as you point out, because Samantha Power, as I mentioned, who's the director of USAID, won a Pulitzer Prize for a book that was critical of the U.S. for not doing enough in previous instances where there were genocides occurring around the world.
So it's hugely ironic, and she's not even been installed yet. She hasn't won Senate confirmation yet. And they're already putting these hold and canceling contracts that she talked about in her Senate confirmation hearing. That the biggest challenges that we face in doing anything about genocide is documenting it. And here's a contract to document the genocide taking place in Nigeria against Christians and Muslims, and they're already canceling those contracts before she can be installed.
I guess we have enough challenges protecting religious freedom in California. So maybe it's these are Susan Crabtree, RealClearPolitics.com's White House and national political correspondent. Susan, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Amy, you remember Andrew Yang, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Wasn't he going to pay people?
Yeah, Mr. Universal Basic Income, right.
Right, right. And also, then, too, remember during the first presidential debate? You'd be the first to call in, and I'll give you thousands of dollars a month. Remember that?
No, yeah.
It was a contest.
And he's real cool, you know, because he doesn't wear a tie.
Right, yeah. He's hip, and he was going to, you remember, I'm moving to Georgia with my family. Because we're going to make sure that those Republican Senate candidates don't get in. Yeah, that guy.
That's right. Well, he's back in New York, and he's running for mayor because Mayor Warren Wilhelm is term limited. We'll miss him dearly.
Oh, no. What's he going to do now?
And there was an interesting piece in the New York Times. Andrew Yang, looking for endorsement, offends Gay Democratic Club. He offended the Gay Democrats because they wanted to talk about policy. They didn't realize that in the modern Democrat Socialist Party, all they are is their sexual orientation. And so he wanted to talk about gay bars, and they wanted to talk about policy. He wanted to pander, and they wanted to talk about policy. So he's still working out some of the kinks, as Andrew Yang. But I took a particular note of this passage in the New York Times piece. I'm quoting, "In the past, he has struggled with issues of tone. His presidential campaign has been trailed by allegations of a bro culture. In one of his own books, he admits to having named his pectoral muscles Lex and Rex."
Oh, no, he did not. When he flexes Lex and Rex, hey, huh?
And it's funny because I thought I was the only one who did that. And so I have real solidarity with Andrew Yang.
What is up with nipples and pecs for people in New York? You got Cuomo with the nipple rings.
Right, nipple rings Gambino, that's right.
Or it could be just tape because he might have a problem. But I'll explain that to you later.
So my pecs are named JB and Lori. So JB is in memory of the pecs that JB Pritzker doesn't have. And Lori is to allow Lori Lightfoot, who desires pecs, to live vicariously through me.
Okay.
And my superfluous nipple, since you mentioned nipples, I've got the third superfluous nipple like Krusty the Clown. That's named Illinois GOP because it's vestigial.
Oh, I see. Wow. You spent some time. I'm not going to look at the time.
Do you have any names for body parts?
No,
Amy,
I don't.
That you'd like to share?
I got long sticks. Those are my legs. And that's all I'm going to say about that. Coming up on
sticks. Got it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Open my. Call in now! Open Mic Friday!
Yeah, it's Open Mic Friday, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Give us a call, take in your comments, compliments, critiques, concerns, crackpottery, whatever. And if the lines are busy, just keep calling. We'll run through as many calls as we can. There's a suspect in custody in the shooting death of that 7-year-old girl, Jaslyn Adams, at the McDonald's drive-thru. Suspect in custody after a rather eventful capture on the Eisenhower. And I have a question for Lori Lightfoot. Should the police have given chase there when the suspect tried to carjack a family and escape? Should they have given chase, or should they have just waited until he ran out of gas after the carjacking?
Yeah, I mean, because it was both. It was a chase in a vehicle, and then a foot chase. Which now she wants to call the supervisor first to get approval. Can you hold the line, please? I got to get approval from my supervisor. Thank you.
Leave those people alone for just 1 minute.
Yeah.
Let them in their car for just 1 minute. Yep. I got to see if I can chase you. If not, then, you know, don't rush yourself.
I mean, just ridiculous. So they captured him, and her father spoke for the first time. He approached, you know, the mics. He was wearing, you know, walking with crutches, and he was, you know, gunshot victim himself. And these were his daughter's last words.
Last words. Daddy. A panicking daddy. I see my daughter face down in my car.
And this is what we had to say. What? I don't understand why they were shooting at us.
That's my baby I just lost. I got shot once. My baby got shot six times. Six times. My baby got shot six times. They still ain't tell me what she got shot at.
Yeah, that was the other day. And but did anybody follow up? Again, the question I have for Mr. Adams.
Yes, please. You in the front row. Yes.
Any idea why two people would open fire on your car in a McDonald's drive-thru?
Ambush you.
Do you think they knew you? Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Adams, what is it you do for a living to support your daughter and your family?
Well, Chicago police say he's a gangbanger, and that's why they were targeting each other, because they're gangs. And there was a shooting right after that at the Popeyes in Humboldt Park at the drive-thru there, where people get out of their car and they ambush your vehicle.
Well, do you want to have the conversation about family and race and policing? I mean, the entire conversation, or don't you, I guess, is the question. The real lack of curiosity, and look, I'm obviously, I'm sorry that his daughter is dead and
adorable.
Whatever he has done or does is no justification or no culpability legally. However, if he is indeed, as police describe him, as somebody who's gang affiliated, what message do you have, Mr. Adams, for a young men in Chicago who are involved with gangs? I mean, if you think that this was gang related and the target was you, do you think those things? And if you do, then what's the message? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. Dawn in Plainfield.
Hi, good morning. I think that those of us who want to see change, we're willing to have a conversation because we want to tease this whole craziness out. In regards to your previous conversation, I don't know what the lady's name is.
Professor Redstone.
Here's what I would ask her in regards to the conversation. I would point out that, you know, there's only 2/3 of students who cannot read proficiently by the end of fourth grade. They'll end up in jail and welfare. So according to statistics from 2017, only 85% of the kids who are in juveniles can read functionally. More than 60% of all prison inmates are functionally illiterate. So my problem with the conversation is those people that want to talk about critical race, they're the same people who are defending the current K-12 system, right? That is the foundational problem. Unless the woke will open up their eyes to reality. And also, I would like to point out that kids with special needs, only 18% approximately, end up becoming independent for functional living. So they need to start looking at the data. You want to have a conversation, then stop ignoring the statistics. Otherwise, these people you can't take them seriously. That's my point of view.
Thanks for the call, Dawn. And on family, too, numbers out this week that the number of kids living in a single-family household has increased over the last 50 years from 15% to 30%. It's doubled. Here's what we know. This is not a comment on single parents as a group. This is not to say causation. It's to say incidence, correlation. What we know to be true, more single parenthood equals more child poverty, school failure, crime, and depression. Kids growing up in communities with more single-parent families are more likely to stay poor and end up in jail. And this takes a toll on them, and it takes a toll on our nation. And by the way, it's not just that statistic. The Census Bureau notes itself, quoting, children's living arrangements can have implications for children's outcomes, such as academic achievements, internalizing problems, for example, depression and anxiety, and externalizing problems, for example, anger and aggression and the commission of crime. So how do you have a conversation that is relevant if you don't talk about family, knowing that those, that is just the reality. That's the data. So what Mr. Adams does or doesn't do matters to his daughter and to his family. Dads matter. Moms matter. Dads and moms together or not together, that matters. Do you want to talk about that? Because not very few people seem to want to. And if you're not going to, then you're not going to get anywhere. We'll just continue running in place. Those numbers will continue to get worse, and so will the conditions for many more children. Bud on the south side.
Hello, Dan and Amy. How are you today?
Good.
Good.
All right. I'm a first-time caller, a long-time listener.
Great.
Enjoy your program. I just wanted to comment about Congress trying to make Washington, D.C. the 51st state. It's typical leftist, no rules, no regulations, power move. And if they were successful on that, if the Senate did go along with that, well, they'd have to amend it anyway. But by doing so, it would be a huge power grab for the left, because then they could protest at all these government facilities for any posture they have on any law or anything they want to get approved their way.
What about this? I agree with you. But what about a swap? What if we compromise, and in exchange for D.C. statehood, they decertify Illinois as a state, so we stay at 50? What do you think?
That's interesting. I wonder if other states would follow suit.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Bud. Appreciate it.
Texas.
Holly in St. Louis.
Hi, Holly.
Well, hello. I'm going to start off on the wrong foot with you. I believe I speak for the entire listening audience when I say Open Line Friday cannot be taken up the first 15 minutes with your thoughts. Jeez, people. Anyway, okay.
Okay. All right.
Duly noted. Thank you.
Holly wants her 15 minutes. Holly Warhol.
Right.
Okay.
Well, exactly. I was feeling very left out of the revolution. Like there was just no revolution going on in my life. So when I read a questionnaire that Alexei Ohanian he was interviewed and somebody asked him what his best favorite book was, he said a book called Why We Sleep. Mm-hmm. And he said he felt embarrassed saying it, but nothing had changed his life more than that book. So because I hadn't slept for 7 years, I decided to order the book, Why We Sleep. It's my new revolution. It has changed my life. To all of the listening audience, if you are not sleeping well, think you could use more sleep, I highly recommend the book, Why We Sleep. And I'll tell you a couple of the changes I've made that have changed my life. No alcohol within 6 hours of bedtime. So now I have to drink all my beer from 9 a.m. to like 3 p.m.
So you have a more enjoyable day when you're awake, and then you go to sleep because you're drunk. Perfect.
Exactly. You don't waste your whole buzz drinking at night. To me, I couldn't believe my whole life. I was in my 50s before I found this out.
I hope the kids are listening, Holly. No, that is a wonderful notes, instructional. Yes.
Please go on. Take all the time you want. Go.
No screens 1 hour before bed. So 1 hour before your bedtime, I say goodnight to my phone, goodnight to the TV, goodnight to everything. I plug it away. And nothing is in your bedroom. I go to bed and wake up at the same time every day. No food within 4 hours of bedtime. No clock in my bedroom. I used to wake up and stare at my clock. 1:45, sleep till 2:17, then wake up at 4:11, then wake up, 5:08,
like
and driving to the, and right. So I say goodnight to my clock and I turn it around. And if I wake up in the middle of the night, I don't have anything to look at. So I go back to sleep. I'm telling you, Why We Sleep will be the revolution we can all get behind.
All right. Thanks for the call, Holly. Appreciate it. Maybe Sean and Darian will, agree to my compromise. Decertify Illinois if we grant D.C. statehood. Okay, Sean.
Yeah, you guys got a great show, by the way. I love you guys. I would move to Florida today
if it wasn't for my kids in school right now. I hope
schools in Florida.
I know. It's tough. I send them to Catholic school, too, by the way. I'm not letting them be brain dead, you know, sitting on the couch all day. But 8 years from now, hopefully I can move to Florida. I mean, it's going to be miserable 8 years here. I can guarantee that. And hopefully it's still being run by an incredible governor like DeSantis. I mean, my God, I mean, the guys, or somebody like him. I don't know if they can make another one like him. I mean, so, and you're lucky to have a place down there. God bless you, Dan. I mean, my God,
yes.
I'd go right now. I really would.
Can I come over, Dan? Can Sean come over?
I'll keep a light on for you, Sean.
We're thinking about doing that golf outing thing. And I know you're already taken, Amy. I know you're open, and so is Sean, but it would be kind of fun to go with Sean. I think we would just sit there and talk politics and stuff all the whole time. You know?
Yeah.
If you go with me, we can talk coaching strategies.
Yeah.
And if you should pick me, go to 560theanswer.com/golf.
I agree. You should pick Amy. And if you go with Sean, just make sure he doesn't hold up the course. All right. We want to get around.
Move it along. I know.
Fast golf is the way we play for sure.
That's right. Slow.
Yeah, ready
slow
golf.
Play kills the game.
Ready
Thanks
golf.
For the call, Sean. Dan in River North.
Hello. Good morning.
Morning.
Dan and Amy, listen to you every morning.
Thank you.
Just want to give you the neighborhood watch update. Yesterday about 4 o'clock. I was walking up North Dearborn at Superior, and I spotted a naked guy.
Mm-hmm.
Just had shoes on.
Well, no shoes, no service, right?
Did he have a mask on?
Had a mask on.
All right.
Little white bag, like he just came. He just left the dime store.
River North, and, naked, just shoes on, white bag. Brendan Riley coming out of Boss Bar?
Oh,
close. He was a little bigger than Brendan Riley.
Oh,
but made his way to State Street, walked in front of Holy Name, and then down to the Red Line on Chicago.
At least somebody's using public transit. Yeah.
So beware. Lori Lightfoot wants to bring a casino to the city. Good luck.
It's coming. It's going to be here.
That's going to be our salvation. And then maybe legalize prostitution or decriminalize it like New York, and then we're gold,
and
right?
Everyone can have affairs. What?
Eduardo at Midway.
Okay, because you probably can see my comment on the screen here, so I better not get away from it. So I was scanning the TV, and I was kind of hoping to see Greta, you know, the girl from Sweden.
Oh, yeah.
Standing in front of a volcano, because, you know, we had that St. Vincent volcano and, you know, those people had a scram. So how are the volcanoes going to agree with the climate accord?
Exactly. Right. We're going to have to cap them like oil wells. Thanks for the call, Eduardo. Appreciate it. We'll stay on climate change. Bob, Buffalo Grove.
2 days in a row. Always great talking to you and hearing your listeners, like Holly's just comment. Thanks, Dan, for your producers in providing an intelligent and serious discussion on climate change. Few media outlets are offering opposing views like those coming from the Heartland Institute. By the way, I listened to the Heartland Institute webinar on climate change this week. I could offer numerous questions on climate change, but let me just ask, who is the bigger idiot, AOC or Lurch Carey? Yesterday, I heard AOC claim climate change, it was due to racism.
Mm-hmm.
And then Kerry offered the need to eliminate CO2. So I wonder how photosynthesis is going to work without CO2. And by the way, the Heartland Institute pointed out that with increased CO2 levels, we are seeing the greening of the earth. We're seeing more plants, trees, crops, because of the increased CO2 emissions. And finally, climate change. I'd like to hear a serious discussion, not the stuff coming from false scientists like the Kerry and AOC, and hear some real scientific engineering knowledge on this subject.
Thanks for the call, Bob. And pick up Patrick Moore's new book. We talked to him yesterday on the topic. And also, thanks for, Bob, you just gave me, gave us a new segment.
What?
Who's the bigger idiot?
Oh, yeah.
That is, I like that. Who's the bigger idiot? We're going to have to work up some music to that.
Justin, Terry, get on that.
Terry in Rogers Park.
Hey, what Ed Burke said about Jewish business owners hiring their own people is true. But it's also true about every other ethnic business owner. Muslims hire Muslims, Chinese hire Chinese, Latinos hire Latinos.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Terry.
He's talking about Jewish lawyers, but okay.
Yeah.
Whatever. He needs to go.
Right.
Dear God. I mean, why has nobody picked up on what his horribly racist comments?
Ed Burke. Commenting on other people who are clannish is comical. Carol in Moments.
Hi, good morning, Dan and Amy. My comment is regarding the decrease in greenhouse gases. This is like a conspiracy thing. You know, you decrease CO2, that's plant food. And then you have less plant growth, and which equals worldwide famine. Exactly what the elite want with a decrease of population.
All right. Thanks for the call, Carol.
Oh, I have something else to...
They definitely are ZPGers. I'm sorry, Amy.
I'm on line three.
Amy in Lakeview?
Yes. Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
First time caller.
Yeah, thanks. A lifetime listener. I wanted to know if you guys knew about this. So if you work for CPS, right? And you have a child that goes to CPS, whether they're in kindergarten or a senior in high school, your child is available to go to school 4 days a week. And the CTU baked that into the contract that they just, that agreement they just made. Did you know about that?
They're available to go to, what do you mean?
So
what does that mean, available to go to school?
They can go to school 4 days a week instead of 2 days like everybody else.
If your child is a member of...
Mm-hmm. If I teach at CPS and I've got two kids, right. my kids can go to school... For 4 days a week.
Well, that's the way it's got to be. You know, to go to school.
I mean, unbelievable.
You know, to go to school in this city, you got to know somebody, you know?
But that's what, I mean, Jesse Sharkey put that in there. Because, you know, because they can't teach if their kids are still home doing e-learning. So the solution was, well, our different rules for our children then. So you have some first graders there in Monday through, it's Monday, Tuesday, and then, you know, Wednesday's a day to clean or whatever. And then Thursday, Friday. Mm-hmm.
All right. Not as entertaining as Chuck from Delavan closing the show, but he was unavailable this week. He called in earlier.
And let us know that there's a Teletubby signing.
Yeah, he's got a dermatology exam, something about wearing Daisy Dukes. I don't know. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.